Everybody, welcome back to the Home Class Movie Chat, the place for all things movies. We are your hosts, married couple and movie addicts, Kat
And Paul.
And we are excited to be back with you. I know we've been on a bit of a hiatus and we've been a little inconsistent, but we're looking forward to changing that.
Yeah, absolutely. We are going to do a brand new format of this show, and it's going to be a little bit more condensed than what it has been over the past. So, you know, this is the brand new format of this whole podcast that we're going to be doing. So stick with us. This is going to work.
Yeah, because the idea behind the home class to begin with was that the best part of going to a movie with somebody is actually discussing it on the way home and picking it apart.
Yeah.
So rather than going through it scene by scene, which was driving me nuts and probably you too, we're going to just kind of summarize it and then just talk about it like we would on the way home from the movies.
Yeah. And we really don't want to get that in depth where you sit there and go, my God, did they leave anything for me to actually go and watch?
Exactly.
We're just going to do, as Kat said, just a brief summary of the movie. We're going to talk about some of the cast, some of the locations that they filmed, some of the trivia that we've got, which is great. Kat's got some great trivia. So look, this week's movie, we're going to be going all the way back to, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest era, 1985, June the 28th, to be exact, 1985.
Wow, I had just graduated from high school.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Well, oh, I'm dating myself.
I'm not going to tell her what that is. We are going to go back and see the movie, St. Elmo's Fire.
Woo!
I can't remember who met who first or who fell in love with who first. All I can remember is the seven of us always together.
Well, it's not just infatuation, Kevin. She's not just a girl. She's the only evidence of God that I can find on this entire planet.
Where did you meet Wendy again?
Prison.
Hi, Felicia, how you doing? Me? Oh, you know, it ain't easy being me.
You know all those nights we stayed up talking? How come you never made a pass at me?
I'm gonna get you a red, lacy baby doll, Nike.
Alec, I'm very happy in your old pajamas.
Well, I'm happy when you're out of my old pajamas.
Alec is becoming a Republican and he wants to get married. Oh my God.
Do you ever feel like you're not accomplishing anything at all?
I think I'm in touch with that emotion.
You're not gonna believe how out of hand it's gonna be.
What did we think of this movie?
I have to say it has arguably one of the best theme songs ever.
Oh, yeah.
I love Man in Motion.
Man in Motion. Yeah, that is a great. I love that. Look, I love the soundtrack of this movie. And this is a thing with a lot of the movie critics. I don't listen to movie critics. I know they've got a job to do. They actually have to sit there and review it. But it's a individual's review. And I think that as far as I'm concerned, as they said, this film is the prominent movie of the Brat Pack genre. Now, if anyone wants to know, doesn't understand who the Brat Pack were, it's just similar to the Dean Martin and the Jerry Lewis and the Frank Sinatra. The Brat Pack consisted of Rob Lowe, Demi Moore, Emilio Estevez, Ali Sheedy, Judd Nelson, and Andrew McCarthy, along with Molly Ringwald. Molly Ringwald did not star in this movie, so that is the only person out of the Brat Pack. But this is a big quintessential Brat Pack movie.
Yes. Okay, so this movie actually has more of the Brat Pack in its cast than any other movies of the time period.
Yeah.
The core members included Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Andrew McCarthy, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, Ali Sheedy. Core Brat Pack members not in attendance were Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall, but the pair had appeared in The Breakfast Club alongside St. Elmo's Fire, Nelson, Sheedy, Estevez, bringing that Brat Pack film total to 5. That is still one less Brat Pack member than St. Elmo's Fire, which had 6.
Yeah. So if you had have added Anthony Michael Hall and Molly Ringwald, it would have been the entire Brat Pack in this movie. But, you know, and when you've got someone like, I'm going to say it wrong, Mayor Whittingham, she's not in the Brat Pack. She's never been in the Brat Pack. She's not a core member. Now, this movie basically, and I like it the way it goes, this movie centers around a clique of recent graduates of Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University.
Which was also where The Exorcist was filmed.
Yes, it was, Georgetown. Yep. And their adjustment to post-university life and the responsibilities of adulthood. Now, you know, as I said, they were saying that this was got negative reviews from critics, but it was a box office grossing $37.8 million on a $10 million budget, which I completely agree with. And this went for 108 minutes. I've always loved this movie. I don't know what it is about the movie, but I just think that the movie itself is quite amazing. You know, you can see there are certainly parts of the movie you can sit there and say, yeah, there is just a lot of growing up that needs to be done. But it really does come down to those people transitioning from just university life into adulthood. Yeah. And from someone that's never been to university, but someone that I'm sitting across from someone that has been, can I ask you to begin with, what is the transition like from being just a full-time student into the real world?
It's a challenge because it is, so each of the graduates holds fast to the unconditional acceptance and affection of their group, a safety net beneath them as they step out into the adult world. Yeah. Not everybody had that. I didn't. I was basically I had friends, but they had gone on to other friends. So I was kind of on my own. And Joel Schumacher says, our early life is a series of plateaus. Adulthood is a state that you are constantly defining for yourself as you go along, hoping that adult is what other people will see. In St. Elmo's Fire, In St. Elmo's Fire, we wanted to dramatize the passion and uncertainty of the time. We also wanted to make the point about self-created drama. When most of us look back on our 20s, we see that a lot of the incredible drama we went through was self-created. I hope that older people will be reminded of what they went through and younger people will see something of themselves and their own lives. Each of the friends faces decisions that will determine his or her future. And I also wanted to, before we jump really into it, to tell you that as you said, the name of the higher education campus that is seen in the movie is Georgetown University. Yeah. I used to actually live in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. It's an awesome area.
Did you ever go to the Exorcist stairs?
No. Because I never saw The Exorcist until I saw it with you.
I am so going to The Exorcist stairs.
Yeah, we'll go there. And all the major characters in the film's story attended Georgetown together. But after reading the script, Georgetown University administrators refused to allow producers to film on campus, so the on-campus scenes were filmed at the University of Maryland instead. No Georgetown University buildings appear in the film at all, except for a long shot from across the Potomac River. And at one point, the guys are seen wearing red and white, jackets,
yeah,
which are from the University of Maryland, not Georgetown.
Really? I didn't know that one. Yep. Now, the long shot that you were talking about from across the Potomac was the same shot that was actually done that was introducing us to Reagan's house in The Exorcist.
That what?
So you know how you see the long shot from across the Potomac into Georgetown? It's the same long shot that you get to see at the opening of The Exorcist when they were being established at Reagan's house.
Yeah. It's a long shot.
It's a beautiful area. I love Georgetown. I could so live there.
Oh, beautiful.
Maybe I'm just in love with Georgetown because that maybe that's what it is.
It is absolutely gorgeous.
Now, as I said, I never ever really listened to, and I don't listen to census and you know things, but I was just reading that on Rotten Tomato, the film has an approval rating of 42% with an average rating of 5.2 out of 10. The site's critical consensus reads, St. Elmo's Fire is most peak Brat Pack. It's got the cast, the fashion, and the music, but the characters are too frequently unlikable. I understand that. There are certainly aspects of the characters. We're going to go through the characters.
Well, I'll be honest with you. It's one of those movies. Okay. I remember seeing, Brooklyn's Finest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which had some great actors in it.
Yep.
And I basically felt like I had wasted 2 hours of my life because I honestly couldn't give a crap about any of the characters. I did not care for, honestly, if they'd all died in mass shooting, I wouldn't have cared.
Well, how did you feel about the characters? And we're going to go through the characters.
Did
you care about the characters?
Close to that.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get into some characters. So we're going to
Before we do that, can I talk about St. Elmo's Bar?
Yes, you can.
A couple of things.
Yes.
St. Elmo's Bar is based on the Tombs, which is a popular watering hole in Georgetown University. And for exterior shots, a full street set built at Universal Studios in Los Angeles was used for that exterior. Now, the street that that they built the St. Elmo's Bar on is in the Universal backlot. Two or three buildings to the left is the Hill Valley Clock Tower from Back to the Future.
No way. Yeah. Oh, my God. I didn't even notice that one. Who's going to have to go back and see this movie again? That'll be me. Uh-huh.
Yep, my God.
That is awesome. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of the casting was really interesting in this. Andie MacDowell actually credits the film for changing her life and career. Now, you wanted to get into talking about liking and caring about the characters. What do you think of Andie MacDowell?
I do not like her. She is one of the biggest, most overrated actresses of all time. I understand, you know, she was in things like Four Weddings and a Funeral. She was in this movie. Green Card. I don't see it. I don't know what it is about her. Now, I don't have anything wrong with her as a person. I just see her as such an overrated actress.
I know. I mean, she's probably perfectly lovely person.
She probably is, but I can't see what people see in her.
Neither.
But so we're going to get into the characters.
She's very flat.
She is very, very flat. She doesn't have a huge, huge range. So
she doesn't have a real emotional range.
So let's start from her then.
Before we jump into that, that's okay. I'll do the
okay. We're gonna try.
The one trivia that I did have for Andie MacDowell is apparently this is the first film she was in where she got to talk in her own voice. I know.
Okay. Right? What?
Yeah. I know. I don't make the trivia. Like I just read them.
So we're saying like Four Weddings and a Funeral. She wasn't talking in her own voice.
I don't know what she did before this.
That's strange. Okay, so let's start in with the characters. So we're going to start off with let's go backwards. Let's go with Andie MacDowell's character. So she actually plays Dale, and she is now she's a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't really get a huge amount of. We don't really know her character very much at all. We only see it through the eyes of Kirby, and we'll get to Kirby. We'll get Emilio Estevez's character Kirby in a minute, but we really just don't get to see a lot of her. But what we do get to see, she's very one dimensional. She's not one of those characters that I'd sit there and go, "Wow, she's got some depth." We introduce into her at the emergency department where Kirby, gets a glimpse of her. And it's a very, very quick interaction because she's got to go. There's a medical emergency. But then we get to see her through a party. We get to see her through, when Kirby goes to her apartment, we get to meet her there. But really, she doesn't really bring much to the movie other than the fact that she is Kirby's obsession.
Now, did you know that according to director and co-scripter Joel Schumacher's audio commentary, co-screenwriter Carl Kurlander purportedly based Kirby's obsession with Dale on his own true life crush of a fellow student he had known on campus.
That's friggin' scary.
Isn't it?
And we will get to...
Kirby is such a stalker.
We'll get to exactly why he is a stalker. So we've done Andie MacDowell. Her character really doesn't bring a whole lot to it. So let's start off with the very, very first one. Let's go with Billy. Billy is Rob Lowe's character.
Can I just tell you?
You can go for it.
Rob Lowe walked into his audition with a six pack of Corona.
That's my boy. At least he's drinking good beer.
There's also a couple of other things that I wanted to.
We are trying to condense this podcast, madam.
What's that?
We are trying to condense this podcast. We don't want to be here for an hour.
Oh, I know, but I've got such great trivia.
Now, Rob Lowe, his character's name is Billy. He's basically a frat boy. He's a very reluctant father and husband, and you can really see it. He's the character that he just doesn't grow up. Yeah. You know, he womanizes. Yeah. He wants to spend his nights, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to spend your nights with your friends, but when you are a father and a husband, you really have to try and rein that in. But Billy just hasn't grown up. And when we first see Billy, he's already been involved in a car accident with his on-again. I mean, I don't know whether it's on-again, off-again girlfriend, because we really don't know whether Wendy is really his girlfriend. I don't really think that Wendy is his girlfriend.
No, she is just in love with him.
Yeah.
Because he has the baby mama.
Yeah. Because when we see him. Yeah.
That Robert Downey Jr. was actually considered for the role of Billy.
In an alternate universe, that might work, but I think Rob really did the Billy. He was actually really quintessentially Billy.
Yeah.
I think Billy was him.
Well, it's interesting because,
I couldn't see Robert.
This movie, in many ways, is Robert Downey Jr.'s life at that age.
Very much so, but he'd already done Less Than Zero.
Yeah.
And Less Than Zero was quintessentially Robert Downey Jr.'s, this is me.
Yeah, that's probably why they considered him. But did you know that director Joel Schumacher originally felt Rob Lowe was not right for the part of Billy? And it was only after repeated phone calls from his agent and a passionate speech about why he wanted the part did Rob eventually get it?
No, I think Rob Lowe was quintessentially Billy. I think he played a great role in this movie. And of course, we do see when we first meet Rob Lowe's character, Billy, it's because he's been involved in a car accident and everyone's meeting him at the emergency department, and he's already totaled poor old Wendy's brand new car. And Wendy is Wendy is just so gaga in love with Billy. It's not funny.
But what she sees in him, I don't know.
I know. She even offers to pay the medical expenses, you know, after he's totaled his car. And everyone's like, you know, seriously, you're paying for the bill. And we also see, obviously, that unfortunately he's, you know, Rob Lowe's character, Billy, has been charged with drink driving, and everyone's very concerned about the whole thing. But, you know, it's Rob. You know, Billy, I've got to stop saying Rob. Billy's, he's just the big party guy. He just doesn't have the understanding of being, he's not mature. He's still in party mode. And even at one stage when, you know, he goes over to Wendy's house for dinner and to meet the family, I don't know why, it's just, you know, just a dinner sort of thing. You know, he always used to go out onto the roof of his, where he lives in the frat. And he would just sit out there and blow his saxophone. He's a great saxophone player. And even Wendy says to him at one stage, you know, you miss it, don't you? And he goes, yeah, I do. I miss school. I think there are people that can't really transition from being school-based to being life-based.
These are the people who say high school is the best years of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. But and unfortunately, Billy is that character. He just doesn't seem to understand where the party boy frat lifestyle in university stops and where real life and responsibility and understanding that there is more to life than partying begins.
Yeah. So now I thought it was interesting that Emilio Estevez originally wanted to play Billy.
No, wouldn't have worked.
No, obviously it wouldn't.
I don't think it would. No.
But Rob Lowe's character is referred to as Billy the Kid in this movie, where Emilio Estevez went on to play Billy the Kid in Young Guns and Young Guns 2.
Yeah, he did.
But Rob and Emilio actually appeared together in The Outsiders 2 years before in 1983.
Yes,
I love that movie. It's based on one of my favorite teen books.
With Patrick Swayze and Ralph Macchio as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So now let's talk about Demi Moore's character, Jules. What can we say about Jules? There are so many things we can say about Jules. Jules is... from a female point of view, I want to get your take on this. As a female's point of view, what do you think of Jules?
I thought she was a total narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know she was the only character whose last name is not mentioned?
No, I didn't know that.
According to the screenplay, it was Juliana Van Patten, in case you were wondering.
Well, we didn't even know her name was just Jules throughout the movie.
Yeah, and I've got some great trivia around her character and whatnot. But I honestly didn't like her.
What was it about her that you didn't like?
She was selfish. She was self-absorbed. She really didn't care about anything or anybody but herself. She didn't care about who she hurt. She was a gold digger. She was a social climber. And she just had no depth. She was just shallow and stupid.
I mean, Jules is... In the context of the movie, she was continuously hyper focused on the death of her stepmother, but she used to call it the step monster.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, you know, she would always ask, you know, people, you know, she would also say to the group about the fact that she's found, you know, places that she can go and, you know, send her step monster to live or get rid of the step monster because, you know, she used to abuse, you know, Jules as when she was younger, which could also mean that Jules was probably maybe told no a couple of times. And that's what the whole idea of like her being this horrible person is, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing is she's not used to anybody telling her no. She's used to just getting what she wants when she wants it.
Well, I mean, it does show you because at one stage she invites Kevin, which is Andrew McCarthy's character, up to her apartment. And, you know, he's like, you know, wow, when did you get all this? And she says, well, you know, why did you think that God made credit? She has got everything on credit. She's living on credit. You know, she is extended.
She has no sense of responsibility.
Yeah. Her paycheck has been extended by 2 months. You know, she's so far in debt, she just can't dig herself out of it. The only way that she can figure how to dig herself out of the hole is to go to speak to her boss, which is the chairman of the bank, the owner of the bank or whatever it is, and ends up by sleeping with him. Mm-hmm. So really, Jules is, as you said, yes, she dresses very, very well, high fashion dress sense. Her apartment's beautiful, well, what you consider to be beautiful. Pink. It's very, very pink. But Jules is that kind of person that she just dates everyone and not really anyone.
She'll sleep with anybody to get ahead.
Yeah, that she can get, you know, but she something is, I mean, she's not the worst character of this movie.
No, but I think that goes to Billy.
No, I think the worst character, I reckon the worst character is coming up, which is Gerby.
Yeah. But I do want to point out that much like her character, Demi Moore had a drug problem when she was cast in the film. And Joel Schumacher went to bat to get her cast.
Yeah, really? Wow.
And he fought hard to cast Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, Emilio Estevez, Andrew McCarthy, and Andy McDowell. He said the studio easily approved Rob Lowe, Ali Sheedy, and Mare Winningham, but he really had to fight for the others to do. But anyway, she had a drug problem when she was cast in the film. And one day Joel Schumacher actually demanded that she leave the set because she was high. She had to go through rehab and promised to stay clean in order to finish playing a character with a drug problem. She later revealed in an autobiography that she had a cocaine problem and was using an eighth of an ounce of the drug every 2 days.
Jesus.
She went to treatment for 15 days and had a counselor with her while she was shooting the film.
See, I don't know what it is about Demi Moore back then, but I think, you know, I think one of the biggest appeals of Demi Moore at this age is that the very, very raspy voice that she's got.
Yeah.
Very, very seductive, very, very sultry voice. I mean, even her look in this movie is very, very seductive and very sultry, and it really, she draws you in.
But it was funny. She actually showed up for her audition on a motorcycle with the tag still on her clothes.
But I like Demi Moore's character. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, her arc of a character, it really is shown towards the end of the movie, and even at the end of the movie, just the arc that she's actually come through. I mean, Billy was an absolute shit to her,
yeah.
You know, in one of the scenes, which but stands then, out to
toward,
me.
Toward the end of the movie, they're parked in front of his baby mama's house, and he's supposed to be going home and honoring his commitment to be a decent dad to his child. And he's sitting there in the Jeep right in front of the house trying to sleep with Jules.
Yeah.
And she making kicks out him with out. Her.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really stands out to me on that whole thing is that when she kicks him out of the Jeep and she goes, because he'd grabbed her car keys and put it down his pants.
Yeah.
So, you know, she is trying to get the keys out of his pants. He's thinking, oh, she's grabbing a hold of my nuts and we're going to get it on. And, you know, he's still in the party boy mode, and she picks the keys up and she looks at him and she goes, I needed a friend tonight, but you break my heart. But then again, you break everyone's heart.
Yeah.
And I think it's at that stage that at that moment, he realizes what he's done is wrong. Hopefully.
I hope.
But when he turns around and he sees his wife standing there in the doorway. Well, no, because they're married. They are married.
Oh, they are.
Yes, they are. They're married.
Yeah, that's right.
She wants an annulment.
That's right. I don't blame her.
But she's married to him, and he looks as if to say, oh, so, shit, damn it. And she just turns around, closes the door, turns off the lights, goes back to bed. You know, yeah. I think his wife has had enough at this stage.
Well, I'm amazed she took it that long.
I mean, even at one stage when he's at the Halloween party that he's in the band with, and she comes in, and you know, there's a guy that she's brought in as a date, I'm guessing, and yeah. Billy says, "Get your hands off my wife," and he goes,
oh, "That's right, yeah." And she says, starts to fight.
Yeah, and she says, "Your wife, you're not married to me. You're married to the friend, your friends in the bar." You yeah. know, it really shows you that, hey, you're married to me. I never get to see you.
Yeah,
you know, you're either
don't act like it.
You're either crashing at your friend's place because you can't come home, or you're off womanizing with every woman that you can find.
Yeah.
So exactly, what is it that you want? You know, what do you want from me? You want me to be you want to be married to me? On the possibility you want to be married to me. I don't yeah. understand that one.
It's like really, it's like keeping her on track is the backup plan.
Yeah. So I know we've sort of like deviated off of Jules. We're going to come back onto Jules. So Jules really, she does have a heart of gold eventually. It just takes her a long time to get there.
Yeah, it's like the crash when she's sitting in the apartment freezing when everything's been repossessed.
Yeah.
That was kind of that was her low point where she finally started to become human.
That was the lowest of the lowest that she could yeah. get. I mean, she had been at that stage. Jules had been fired from her boss, her job, because I mean, she'd been sleeping with the boss, but of course that didn't work out. And we find that Jules had been going every day to the hospital to speak to her stepmother, but it didn't really matter because her stepmother was in a coma. But as Jules said,
and she was out of the will.
Yeah, but Jules said, we've had some of the best conversations we've ever had, but she's in a coma, which really pisses me off. So really, you know, she was pouring her heart out to a woman that couldn't hear her anyway. So what would Jules' arc be? It would basically be at the end, which was she needs to find an apartment and get a job. And I think at that stage, and even at one
stage,
that's
when she finally starts to become an adult.
Well, I think one of the biggest arcs and the biggest turnings of this movie is the fact that when Rob Lowe gets into her apartment where everything's been repossessed, and he's speaking to her about St. Elmo's fire, about the fact that you know, sailors would use St. Elmo's fire to guide them while they're on voyages, but the trick was basically on them. There was no St. Elmo's. It was just basically a folklore story to keep them going. Mm-hmm. And she says, I'd never thought I'd be so tired at 22. And it is. And as he says, as Billy says, we're all going through it. This is our time on the edge. This is what we're going to go through. But I think her biggest arc in the movie was that low point where she's got nothing to her name. Her Jeep's gone. Her apartment's gone. Her furniture's gone. She's left with just basically the clothes on her back.
And she's basically sitting there in the middle of winter with all the windows open, trying to freeze herself out.
Yeah.
And commit suicide through
freezing to pneumonia. Death or get a pneumonia. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now we get on to
actually hang on.
Yeah. Sorry.
So the way she was cast was really interesting.
Okay.
Joel Schumacher, who's the director, saw Demi Moore walk down the hallway in his office's building and asked a colleague to run after her to find out if she was an actress. Schumacher's production office was at the time in the same place as that of John Hughes' office, where Moore had just been visiting regarding a casting call.
Really? Okay.
Yep. I have fun trivia.
You do. And I'm so glad that they actually cast Demi Moore in this movie. I mean, yeah. And I've always wondered, you know, I mean, I do another podcast, The Horror Crypt, and I guess I'm answering my own question for this because I've always wondered why. I wonder if Hollywood celebrities actually sit down and watch their own movies. And I remember an interview with Johnny Depp, and someone actually asked him, do you ever watch your own movies? And he said, I do what I need to do, and then I just forget about it, move on to another thing. I don't watch yeah. them. I've always wondered if they actually sit down and watch their movies. But then again, when I do The Horror Crypt, I do an episode and I forget about it and I move on. So
I remember reading an interview with Harrison Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a World War II era drama called Hanover Street.
Yes, I saw that one.
I have never seen Hanover Street. I actually want to watch it.
It's a great movie.
Well, according to Harrison Ford, it's one of the worst things he ever did. And once he can find 20 people to actually say something nice about it, then he'll consider watching it.
Yeah, well, I'm one. I thought it was good.
19 more to go.
We've got to get 19 more to go. So now we move on to Emilio Estevez's character, and his name is Kirby.
Now, I'd like to point, nice little transition there, because I have a trivia here that Emilio Estevez and Demi Moore began dating during the filming of this movie. He said he was deeply in love with her, and for a time they were even engaged, but they never got married.
Oh, Emilio. Yeah. At least she dated and got engaged to Demi Moore. She's good.
Well, and of course, everybody knows that Emilio Estevez is actually a Sheen. He's Sheen's son.
And Charlie Sheen's brother.
And brother of Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
But he wanted to establish his own reputation on his own without thinking that it's because his dad is Martin Sheen. So he used his mother's maiden name of Estevez.
That's like Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage's last name is actually Scorsese.
Yeah.
And he decided he wanted to make it on his own without being under the name of Scorsese. So
who's his daddy?
Martin. So,
think Nick Cage has done a beautiful job of that.
He has. He's a great, great actor. I really love.
He's Nick one Cage. Of my favorites. I will pretty much see almost anything that Nick Cage does.
Now, Emilio Estevez's character Kirby. Yes. What do we think about him? I know you've got some strong opinions of him, but what do we think of him?
He is an effing stalker. Okay, so in the movie, Emilio's character of Kirby and Andrew McCarthy's character of Kevin are roommates.
Yep.
And during the filming, they actually roomed together to prepare to be.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Roommates. Yeah.
That's a great idea. That's some good preparation.
Yeah, I like that.
Kirby is an absolute stalker. He had actually he had an obsession or an infatuation with Andy McDowell's character Dale. And, you know, it was really, really weird. You know, the first scene we see Kirby, he goes back to the apartment where Kevin and him share. And he walks in, and Kevin is a writer, and we're going to get to Kevin, and he is writing about what the meaning of life is. And so as Kirby comes home, Kevin goes, "Quick, what's the meaning of life?" And Kirby says, "Dale." And he's like, "Dale, who?" And he goes, the doctor at the hospital tonight. And he goes, "Did you see it?" And he's like, "Not really." And he goes, "Well, if you remember, there was a statue in Georgetown University. There was a big statue that said life and I think it was death or life and knowledge or something." And he goes, "And she was sitting on the life side and she just smiled at me." That's his whole idea of infatuation. You smile at Kirby, you are in trouble.
Yeah.
So much so that Kirby ends up because there was a big Halloween party that was going on at St. Elmo's, and Billy was there playing in his band, and of course there was a big argument that started between Billy and his wife that led to a fist
fight. Kirby is a waiter.
Yeah, Kirby's a waiter, and he intervened in the fight, and he got fired along with Billy.
Yeah.
So, you know, Billy, so there's Kirby trying to find a job, and he ends up by...
And I think it's because he took the Billy's side as opposed to the patron.
I didn't really see that he did.
No.
Really see it, but something happened that Kirby was fired. So Kirby ends up by getting a job with a very wealthy Asian businessman. And this is where the infatuation really gets out of hand, because he ends up by throwing her a big party and says to, and at one stage, you know, because he had originally, and this is how stalkery poor old Kirby is. Kirby is studying to be a lawyer. He meets up again with Dale. I'm going to law school. And then from there, you know, he decides,
well, no, she wants somebody who actually has money.
That's right. Because he's.
So he gets the job as the man Friday to the Asian guy, the rich Asian guy.
Because what had actually happened was that he had met Dale at some stage and had said, and she had, he went back to her apartment and she was trying to explain to Kirby that when I got into medicine, I thought it was about saving people's lives. But what I really think about is that I think it's all about money. Now, what she was trying to explain to Kirby is that it's not money as far as I need someone with money. It's that medicine is predominantly about money. It's about the big conglomerates, the big pharmaceutical companies that want us to only treat the symptoms and actually not treat the person.
Yeah,
so exactly. The more money that we can actually milk out of the patients, the better it will be.
Yep.
So Kirby takes this whole thing of like, oh, That's right. You don't want to be with me because I don't have money. Well, thank you very much, Dale. And that's when he goes off, decides he's not going to be in medicine. He's going to go and become the attaché to this businessman where he's going to earn a huge amount of money. So his idea is like, well, if I get huge amounts of money, start stalking Dale, she'll end up by coming to my idea. So
she'll fall in love with me because I have tons of money.
So this is where he actually invites her to this party that he's throwing at Mr. Kim's house. And she's like, and she does not say, I will be there. She says, I will try. That's all there
is. I don't think she ever came.
She didn't come because she was actually, she wasn't on call. We find out what actually happens with Dale and Kirby. But Kirby's he's a stalker. Straight out, right then and there. I mean, any woman that would actually think that being stalked by this guy is attractive, I'm sorry, you need to go down the path of there's something really wrong, because it's not a good idea at all. So then we transition to Ally Sheedy's character. Ally Sheedy is...
Well, hold on.
Yes.
Before we leave Kirby, I just want to point out that C. Thomas Howell, if you remember from E.T., auditioned for the role of Kirby, but didn't get it because he was too young.
I think they got the balance just right with Amelia.
Yeah, I think Amelia was beautiful in this film. I really do.
He really was. He needed a lot of growing up. I think Billy and him needed to get together and be roommates. Those two needed to grow up. Actually, yeah, I think those two are the big arcs that needed to grow up, because really, you know, you don't go and stalk someone that just happens to smile at you, and then you decide to change from being a lawyer to being a doctor because you've suddenly, you know, re-infatuated yourself.
Yeah,
I mean, at one stage he invites her to go to lunch with him, and he goes to the restaurant, and he's getting everything prepared, and he rang Jules and asked her advice on wine and stuff like that. And Dale arrives at the luncheon, and they sit down, and he does say something about it was a movie that he'd seen that with her, which was Annie Hall, I think it was. And so they sat down with each other. They're about to start lunch. The phone, the waiter comes over and says to, you know, Annie McDowell's character, Dale, oh, there's a phone call for you. She picks up the phone. She answers. She says, oh, yes, doctor, right away. And says, oh, sorry, I've got to go back to the hospital. He'd been sitting there for about 3 hours preparing for the whole luncheon for her to sit down and get up within 60 seconds, you know. Even so, when he says to Dale, she says, oh, you know, I hope we can do this again. And he goes, well, when? And she goes, well, I don't know. Give me a call. So, you know, he's gung ho on the whole
thing.
He's
trying to let him down easy, but
yeah, but he's really, I want to, when can I see you again? So, you know, but Emilio Estevez's character unfortunately makes a big catastrophic mistake. We might as well talk about it now. So, Emilio's character, Kirby, throws the big party. She doesn't arrive. He rings the hospital. Nope. She wasn't called in. So he rings her apartment. No answer, because her roommate is on the phone. So he rides over. He goes over to the woman's house, only to find...
Doesn't he borrow Mayor Winningham's car?
Yes, he does. Mayor Winningham. We're going to get to her. But she's got this very nice car. He grabs a hold of her car, drives over to Dale's apartment, and confronts the roommate that says, listen, where the hell is she? I'm throwing a party for her. Where the hell is she? And we find out that she's actually gone away into the woods.
To a mountain cabin with her boyfriend.
With her boyfriend for the weekend. What does Kirby do?
He goes to the cabin.
Kirby goes to the cabin.
He finds out where the cabin is and bullies the roommate into telling him where the cabin is and drives there.
And if that is not the biggest red flag of being a stalker, I do not know what is.
I'm just glad she's there with her boyfriend.
He gets to the door. He's knocking on the door. The guy opens the door and he says, who the hell are you? Well, who the hell are you? And he says, you know, I'm looking for Dale. And Dale comes to the door and she is like, oh my God.
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here? So it's at this stage that Kirby decides to chuck a bit of a shit and jumps back into the car, only to find that he's got no traction. He's got no snow tires. He's stuck there. Absolutely. Yeah. He's not going anywhere. Yep. And at one stage, so obviously, you know, he says, I'm going to stay in the car. And she's like, and
you can't stay in the car. You'll freeze.
Yeah. So he gets invited into the cabin. And this is where Kirby again does the pouting thing. He says, he's a doctor, isn't he? And she's like, I think we need to talk in the morning about what's going on, you know. And she offers him the guy's pajamas. And he's like, well, what? These are his pajamas. And she says, I really think we need to talk in the morning. And when the morning comes up, you know, the guy's got the car ready. You know, it's a little bit more solid. He can drive out. And she does actually say to him, this is very flattering, but, you know, I think in the end, it's going to be probably my loss that this doesn't go any further, but it's not going to go any further. And the boyfriend says, listen, I'm going to go in and get the camera to take a photograph of you two. And as he had gone into the cabin, this is where Kirby decides to plant the big one on Dale's lips and then drives away almost like in triumph. And I've kissed her. Yay.
Yeah.
But really, in all honesty, this is the biggest red flag that Kirby really needs professional help. He is very dangerous. Because as you said, if she had not been there with the guy, I don't think that he would be rapery. I don't think he would do that.
I wouldn't put it past him.
He's a very, very damaged character.
I honestly wouldn't have put it past him.
But even though he's a damaged character, a lot of the, you know, the critics were saying they're unlikable. He's got some likable qualities about him.
Yeah, he does.
But not that one at all.
It reminds me a little bit of a boy in high school that had a crush on me that I just couldn't return.
Well, you are cute, so I understand. Ally Sheedy's character, Leslie. Now, Leslie she's a really great person. But Leslie she's trying to rein in her boyfriend, which is Alec, which is Judd Nelson's character, which we're going to get to. Leslie is just finding her way. She's got a job. They've moved into the apartment. They're just finding their way in a relationship. And Alec is very much along the lines of he wants to be married. And it's because that he's in the government. But we'll get to what happens with Alec.
Would you like to know who else was considered for the role?
Yeah, What happens with who is Leslie going to be?
Brooke Shields.
Okay.
Meg Ryan.
Maybe.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
No.
Melanie Griffith. Maybe.
No. Very, very tentative. Maybe.
Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah, I can see that.
Really? I can't.
Yeah, and in her younger days, yeah, I can see her.
Bridget Fonda.
The next one
I could have actually seen.
Okay.
Elizabeth Shue from Karate Kid fame.
Yes, I could see that, yeah.
And Jennifer Jason Leigh were all considered for the role of Leslie.
Out of all of them, I would say...
Elizabeth Shue.
Elizabeth Shue and the one previous, Bridget Fonda. Those two.
I could have maybe seen Meg Ryan.
No, because she really hadn't done anything.
Yeah, I don't know who they auditioned for, but Anthony Edwards and Leah Thompson did also audition for the movie.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. But yeah, I can definitely see that out of all of them, Elizabeth would be a good Leslie. But, you know, Leslie is, you know, she's almost like she's palling around with Mia Whittingham's character. I can't remember her name.
Wendy.
Because at one stage, you know, Leslie is trying to rein in a lot of what Jules is doing. And at one stage, Jules and Leslie go to these, because Mia Whittingham, we've got to get to her, but she's actually a really lovely character. Mm. She works at a soup kitchen. She also works at a...
By far the best person in the entire cast.
Yeah, because she's got a lot of depth in her.
Yeah.
She comes from an extremely wealthy, wealthy family.
And doesn't take advantage of it at all. You would never know that she comes from money, except for the fact her father gives her things like the car
and money when she needs it. And she's working at Social Security. And so... Yeah. You know, there's Jules and Leslie going to ask her to go to lunch, and Jules is dressed up to the nines. Leslie's very conservative, being dressed the way that she dresses. And the whole thing was, we're going to take you to lunch because we are concerned about this thing with you and Billy. Because Billy,
it's an intervention.
Yeah, it's like, Wendy, this relationship that you guys have got is way too explosive. And she's like, well, it was actually a different thing. Leslie and I are actually worried about you because of this relationship with your boss. And the fact is that you're living on credit and you've got no direction and you're all over the place. So, you know, Leslie's character is really, she's trying to find her way. And at one stage, when they go to a party, which has been the Kirby's throwing for Dale, you know, Judd, not Judd Nelson's character, Judge Nelson's
Andrew
character,
McCarthy.
Alec comes out and basically says that, by the way, that she's going to be, you know, Leslie's going to be doing me the great honor of becoming my wife. And this is where Leslie sort of like takes him aside into the kitchen and says, excuse me, I thought we were going to talk about this. And we are not going to talk. We're not going to do this right now. And he's like, oh, please, you know, would you stop using your goddamn career as an excuse to not marry me? And she says, he says, you're just afraid to commit. And she's like, no, I'm not afraid to commit. I need something for myself first before I can give it to you, which is basically, I need to formulate my life.
Bit of a life before she turns it all over to him.
Yeah. And so this is where he says, you know, stop using your career. And she says, okay, fine. Here we go. How do we get over your extracurricular love life?
Yeah.
And he's like, what extracurricular love life? And she goes, uh-huh. Please, come on, Alex, come on. And this is where he goes, what did Kevin tell you? Now, Kevin is Andrew McCarthy's character. And he's actually
in love with Leslie.
He has been in love with Leslie for the longest time, which we're going to get to. And so this is where Judd Nelson's character, Alec, actually confronts Kevin and gives him a belt across the mouth. And, you know, Leslie comes into the whole argument and says, it was only, Kevin didn't tell you, it didn't tell me anything. A hunch until
you
now.
You just confirmed it.
Yeah, you just confirmed that you are a cheater. And even at one stage, you know, Kevin comes over to Alex and Leslie's apartment and, you know, he'd gone and bought her some very nice lingerie and she went off to try it on. And even Alex says, oh, well, you know, what happened was I went to buy this lingerie and there was this very leggy blonde saleswoman that offered to model it for me. So we ended up doing it standing up in the dressing room. And it's like, okay. And he goes, well, so you want to get married? And he goes, yes. And he goes, so marriage will make you faithful? And he goes, yes, it will. And he's like, and Kevin's like, I'm sorry, I don't see it.
Yeah.
Because your extracurricular love life is stopping. And this is why Alec thought that Kevin had gone and blabbed to Leslie. Yeah. Because the only person that he knew that Alec had gone and had sex with was Kevin.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, well, while you guys are, you know, when Alex is not around, I can go and to Leslie to say, by the way, your boyfriend's cheating on you.
Yeah. But I'd say Alec is such a tool.
So Leslie is really trying to be, you know, trying to explain to Alec that this is not going to happen. But of course, it all falls apart. Alec ends up by kicking her out of the apartment that night of the party.
Yeah.
And we end up by seeing that Leslie goes to spend the time and staying at Jules's apartment, which is a good idea.
Now, Ally Sheedy recommended Judd Nelson for the role of Alec.
That I wouldn't.
Yeah, because they had been in The Breakfast Club in 1985 and then in Blue City in 1986.
Yeah, he was awesome in The Breakfast Club as Bender.
Oh, I totally missed this. Sorry, going back to Jules for 1 second.
Yeah.
Jodie Foster, Jennifer Beals, Tatum O'Neill, and Joan Cusack all offered the role of Jules and turned it down. And ultimately, it obviously went to Demi Moore.
No, Demi is Jules, 100%.
But I did want to, where is it? Hang on, there was one other trivia bit. Okay, so Ally Sheedy. No, sorry, when we get to her and Kevin, that's when I have my next.
Okay. So the next one we're going to go with is Judd Nelson's character, and his name obviously is Alec. He's in the government. He's actually trying to be a senator or trying to work with a senator. He starts as being a Democrat and he goes into being a Republican. I don't know what the difference is being a Democrat to a Republican, but apparently Alex's idea is like he's moving up in the world by going from Democrat to Republican. But as
back in the 80s, it wasn't such, the Republicans were not complete wackadoodles.
Okay.
Like they are now.
Yeah.
You know, let's not even go there. Don't get me started. But that we're talking Reagan era.
Reaganomics. Yeah. I've heard of Reaganomics.
But we're talking Reagan era here. So it wasn't as completely wackadoodle as it is now 2023.
So, well, as in 2024 now, because we're in February. Yeah. But now, so Judd Nelson's character, you know, he, as we've said, Alec, he seems to be the, as they say, the rock that's holding the entire group together. When there's a problem with Jules, Alec is there as the knight in shining armor. Alec is getting Billy jobs, because every single time that Billy loses a job, Alec finds him a new one. You know, he's got a job for Billy as an upholsterer, or, you know, tending bar, or something. He's got jobs for every time that Billy loses a job, Alec goes and gets another job. So he's trying to maintain. Alec is trying to, you know, get into the legislature. He's trying to work with the Republicans. He's trying to move up in the world in the legislation. He's trying to hold the group together. He's trying to keep Billy in jobs. He's trying to be there as the rock for Jules. At one stage, you know, Jules rings up Alec in the middle of the night and says, and she's at a party, and she says, you know, I don't know. She's spending the evening with some Arabs, as she says.
Yeah.
And she says, I don't know much Arabic, but I thought I heard the word gangbang. So he races, because Alec races over to the hotel where she's having the party, goes in there and rescues her, only to sit there and go.
She doesn't want to leave because they're giving her drugs.
Yeah. And of course, as they're leaving, you know, Alec says, well, those guys hardly, you know, impress me as the gangbang type. They're all sitting around watching MTV, and she's in the middle of doing drugs. And as they're leaving, you know, he offers to drive Jules home. And of course, you know, Jules is like, no, I've got all this coke. I don't want to leave. So I'm going to go and ring up this very hot Jewish guy and obviously get into his bed for the night. So Alec is trying to be the rock for everyone, but also is a huge womanizer. But as you know, Leslie says, you don't really want to be married. You just want the Christmas cards from us, you know, over the people's mantel places. You know, it's not the fact that you really want to be married. You just want the idea of being married without being married, because you're a womanizer. You continuously sleep with everybody. So Alec, he is a likable character in some regard, but an absolute dick on another regard, because he's you can see what he's trying to do, but you can see that he's failing at every turn. He's trying to keep Billy going. He even says to Billy, you know, you're putting so much pressure on the rest of us because you're not stable, you know. But then again, he can say the same thing to Jules. You know, you're putting pressure on us, Jules, because you're not stable. You're all over the place. You're sleeping with your boss. You're sleeping with everyone. I mean, I don't care if you're living on credit. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother anyone if you're living on credit. But the fact is that in this scenario, it's just becoming a lot of pressure on everybody.
Yeah, so Alec they have to all pick up the slack.
Yeah, so Alec is trying to get himself together, trying to make his way in his career, plus still trying to woo Leslie into the idea of being married, which is failing because, you know, you can only lead a horse to water. You can't make it drink. But when you look at it, Leslie is a good idea that Leslie stays away from Alec as far as being married, because this is not going to end up very well.
No.
So we
So she ends up staying with Jules for a while.
Yeah. And this
that painting in her very pink apartment
is Billy Idol. Yeah, it is, with the big fro at the front of his hair, which is in neon pink light. I mean, it is amazing. But when you see them, that's the only way that Leslie finds out that everything had been repossessed, because she was actually home when Jules had gone to work. See, when Jules had gone to work, we were thinking that she was going to work, when in actual fact, Leslie found out that Jules had been fired over 2 weeks ago, and she'd been going to the hospital to speak to her stepmother, who was in a coma. So when poor old Leslie was staying with Jules, the repo men came and
took the entire apartment.
Yeah, repossessed everything. And poor old Leslie was sitting there going, oh, no furniture, no nothing, no bed, no nothing.
I always thought it was hilarious, though, that when at one point when she was still at the height of her selfishness.
Oh, Jules.
What was his name? Andrew McCarthy's character, Kevin was over at the apartment, and she was trying to introduce him to her very gay neighbor.
Yeah. Because, we're going to get to exactly why they're trying to be introduced Kevin to a gay neighbor. So Mayor Whittingham's character, which is Wendy has got a heart of gold.
Wendy was lovely.
She is really lovely. I've not seen very much, if all, of her acting, but I like her character because this character has actually got depth. Her character comes from money. Her father and her family run a cardotology, which is greeting cards.
Mm-hmm.
They run the company. And a lot of the people that are in the family all run their own franchise, and they're very wealthy. And there is Wendy, and she works at the Social Security office and soup kitchens.
Which her dad hates, and he wishes that he just let her, that she would just let him pay for her life.
Yeah.
But I respect the fact that she wants to earn her own way.
Yeah, she does. She wants to move out. She wants to get her own apartment. She hasn't spoken to her parents about moving out at this moment. But she's trying to explain to the family that she wants to make it on her own without the money. And at one stage, there's a very nice guy, because one stage Billy is invited over. This is what I was saying.
Well,
about.
Her dad basically says if she'll give up Billy and date this other guy, then he'll give her the car.
Yeah, because Billy comes over for dinner one night, and he's one of the family members said, "Oh, you know, please don't tell your father about you moving out." And she's like, in front of your boyfriend, and she's like, "He's not my boyfriend." And they go, "Oh, well, there's a really nice guy, Howie Krantz, that's actually at the firm right now, working for us." And this is where, as I said, at one stage, you know, Billy goes out onto the roof of the house, and this is where Wendy comes and says, you miss, you know, being in college, don't you? And so she's really trying to make it on her own. She's trying to make it as, I don't want to live on my father and mother's wealth. I want to do it by myself.
But she does use daddy's money for things like paying for Billy's medical bills.
An apartment. Because at one stage, you know, the father gives her $300. And this is where that night when Billy comes over to have dinner, and he's not very considerate of Wendy. Wendy is a rather overweight girl. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with it at all. But Billy basically has the tact of a raging bull.
Yeah.
Because they go into the study, they sit down, he offers her a drink, and then they start to make out. And, you know, the first thing that Billy does is puts his hand up her skirt.
Yep.
But he finds that she's wearing like very tight, like leggings or pantyhose or something.
Yeah.
And he snaps it and he goes, "It's your scuba suit." And she gets very, very
Actually, it was probably a girdle.
Something like that. And she becomes very, very embarrassed. And he says, "Oh, sorry, Wend, you know, you can make fun while you're screwing." And then she looks at him and she goes, "I don't think we should see each other anymore." And then puts some money on at his feet and goes, "There's your rent money," and walks away and goes upstairs to bed. So, but in Billy's defense, in that scene, he doesn't take the money. He leaves the money there.
Yeah.
So in that scene, he's actually really nice. But she's trying to be not living on her mother and father's money. And we find in the next scene is that she has actually not started seeing Howie, because it's like, well, if you get engaged to Howie, you can have the car and the money. So when she goes to pick up Jules and Leslie, is like, "Oh, so you're officially engaged?" And she goes, "Nope, I'm officially thinking about it. I'm not actually going to officially be going down the path of marriage." So this is where we do see that this is why Kirby ends up by taking poor old Wendy's car to go and stalk Dale, because it's a very nice car. It's a convertible
Mercedes or something.
No, it's a Chevrolet or something. Oh, yeah. It's a Dodge.
But I do have some fun trivia for Mara Winningham.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so first, her parents, Martin Balsam and Joyce Van Patten, were married in real life from 1957 to 1962.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
I love that.
That's a nice bit of trivia.
Yeah. So Mare Winningham played a virgin while she was actually pregnant with her third child during filming.
That's why I was saying to you that they were dressing her in a lot of sweaters, and like her dresses were very big. And they were trying to make her, I mean, obviously she was pregnant, but they were trying to make her look more frumpy.
Yeah.
And she really was. She did look frumpy. You know, if you put her next to Jules and Leslie, she's the frumpy one of the group.
At the time that they were filming, actor Rob Lowe was the youngest of the cast, while Mare Winningham was the eldest. So Rob Lowe was about 19, and Mare Winningham had already had two children.
Wow. That's not bad. But we do see... Yeah.
What's that?
No, I was going to say, we do see that eventually Wendy's character does end up by moving out by herself into her own apartment. And I love that when Billy goes over there, and because, you know, she had actually, you know, told him that she was a virgin and that she wanted to, you know, I don't know what it
was. Wait until marriage.
She just didn't want to wait to marriage.
Didn't she sleep with him at one point?
She slept with him in this scene, because at this scene we see that she's in her apartment and you know, Billy's over there and saying, you know, the apartment looks really great, Wendy. And she's like, yeah, but you know what's really great? She said, I woke up last night and I got myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And it was my apartment, it was my kitchen, and it was the best peanut butter and jelly sandwich I've ever had in my entire life. And when he says, well, are you still a virgin? And she says, well, why is it that my sexual, you know, ranking, why does it affect you? Because he's going to be moving away. Yeah. And he does say, well, would it be so bold of me to ask for a going away present? And this is where they sleep together. And this is what Wendy had been wanting all along.
Ended up regretting it terribly.
Well, no. They didn't end up regretting it. She was.
No, but, yes, she did.
Why? In what regard?
When she realized that he was just using her and not wanting a relationship, she regretted ever sleeping
with him. But no, because this is basically what I'm talking about. That scene is the end of the movie, because when we see that Billy is now going to New York to play his saxophone, but he still kisses her tenderly as they leave, as he leaves to go to New York. So even though, because he does say, would it be so bold of me to ask for a going away present? Because he already has told them that he's going away to New York to see if anyone would be, you know, silly enough to let him play his saxophone in a band. Mm-hmm. So he's going away there. So he's leaving the group. So he actually asks her, could I sleep with you? And this is what Wendy had been wanting all along. She was so infatuated and so in love with him that she was willing to do that, but it wasn't the right time.
Yeah, but she had basically told him to get out of her life at her parents' house.
Yeah, and then it was sort of like it rectified itself. Mm. Things became better after he'd said, well, I'm going to leave my wife, leave my child, and go to New York. So this is why, you know, Billy was not the nicest of characters, because though that he was, his arc as a character grew, he was still very selfish.
That's the thing. I don't think he grew at all.
Well, because no, and the only reason I'm saying that he grew is because his wife says to Billy, you know, do you remember the guy that I used to date before we started dating? Well, he's still single and he wants to marry me. He'll take care of me and Melody, which is Billy's child. And when he does say, you know, everything will be fine, there'll be no more drinking, no more womanizing, don't give up on me. When he makes the conscious decision to go, you know what, you deserve to be happy. I can't give you happiness. I'm going to let you marry this guy. I'm going to give you an annulment, and I'm not going to be one of these see you on the weekend dads. I'm going to just let this guy adopt Melody as his child, so you guys can have a better life without me. I think that was a very big thing that Billy did, is that he understood where he was in his life, where she was, and it wasn't fair to hold her back because he was such a damaged character.
Yeah.
He was a damaged person.
I don't see that as growth. I see that as him as great. Now I don't have to be responsible for this.
Oh, absolutely. I see that as well. I see that as I'm going to get rid of my previous life to go to my new life. But I'm doing it for myself, but I'm just disguising it as I'm doing it for the good of you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now the last character we got.
Now, before we move on from Wendy, I have one more piece of trivia.
Okay.
Her character is Jewish.
I didn't see that.
Wendy was Jewish.
Okay.
Mare Winningham was raised Roman Catholic, but was non-religious at the time of the filming of this movie. About 20 years after making St. Elmo's Fire, so around 2005, she converted to Judaism.
Really? Okay.
I thought that was interesting.
That was actually a really great one.
Yeah.
So the very last character we've got to talk about is Andrew McCarthy's character. And Andrew
McCarthy. I love Andrew McCarthy. Wasn't he the one that was in Mannequin?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, I love that movie. That was a fun little movie.
His character is Kevin.
Yeah.
Kevin is an aspiring writer. He actually writes for the paper, but he's trying to write the meaning of life, and he wants to get his own article published in the newspaper. But he wants to, because he says, you know, at one stage when he does succeed and he gets his article put in the newspaper, oh, well, you know, I'll probably be back to writing obituaries tomorrow. But he's been really trying to, and he's got all these notes, and he's trying to be a writer, but he's struggling, but he's making headway. And at one stage, he is coming home to his apartment where he shares with Kirby, and there's this prostitute, and the prostitute is always asking guys for a date, and he says to her, why don't you ever ask me for a date? And she says, oh, I thought you were gay. And he says, what would make you think that I'm gay? And she goes, you know, I'd never see you with a girl, and you look really strange. I don't think that really constitutes you being gay. In her mind, it does, but in other people's minds,
the strange,
like,
I don't get. The very well dressed and meticulous appearance, that I get.
Yeah, but I don't now, see him as being gay on that alone.
But never seeing him with a girl, yeah, I can understand.
Okay,
that.
But still,
but well, my ex husband's mother was starting to wonder if he was gay because he never brought any girls, up. And he was in his mid-30s and wasn't married yet. So
okay, well, yeah.
I won't say he was that meticulous.
But Kevin does actually dress very well.
But I would like to say, though, that the interchanges between Kevin and the hooker were based on conversations between a hooker and a limo driver that Joel Schumacher had once overheard.
Oh, my God. Okay.
I love that. I just think that's hilarious.
But we do find out that Kevin... And when he does say to the hooker, he says, well, for your information, I'm actually in love with somebody, but yet she doesn't know it. And she goes, oh, okay. So you've got a secret love. We find out that he's actually been amazingly in love with Leslie.
For years.
And for years and years, so much so that he keeps a box of all her pictures in his apartment. And at one stage, when the whole scenario of Alec and Leslie breaking up and Alec throwing her out of the apartment, she goes over to Kevin and Kirby's place to possibly get a room for the night, because yep. I don't know where else to go. And they're just sitting there talking and drinking away. And, you know, and he does say to her, you know, there is a reason why I haven't dated for so long. I haven't had sex for so long. It's because I am totally and utterly in love with you.
And he's like, he doesn't deserve you because he, you know, and they find, and she realizes what a womanizer
Alec is
and what a great guy
Kevin is.
And
I love it how Kevin
right
says
in front of her all along.
Yeah. And I love it how Kevin sits there and goes, oh, because they're drinking away. And he's like, oh, it doesn't matter. We won't remember about this in the morning. And she goes, Kevin, it is the morning. And that's where they start to get very amorous with each other, and they end up by sleeping with each other.
Okay. Now, Ally Sheedy was horrified by her sex scene with Andrew McCarthy. And it wasn't until the day of filming that she realized it wouldn't be a simple fade out before any of the naked stuff happened where she wore a bodysuit.
Yeah.
Both McCarthy and Joel Schumacher made the process more comfortable. He knew I felt awkward and he shot it fast, Sheedy said of Schumacher. He didn't draw it out into this painful exercise at all. And in fact, a mishap actually added some laughter to the scene when the shower door was pushed out of frame.
Oh my God.
It was an accident.
Oh no. It was.
They kept it in the film, and Sheedy said her reaction was my real laugh.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. If you do see this movie, everyone, when they're making love in the shower and he pushes her against the shower glass, the glass breaks, and you hear her go, oh my God, Kevin, I just broke your shower. But unfortunately, this whole thing backfires because there they are, and they're, you know, had their amorous moments in bed, and they're laying there next to each other. They're just kissing each other. And we hear the door open. Now we think the Kirby's come home, but we find out that the leggy blonde sales girl that Alec had gone and slept with in the changing room, Kevin had given Alec a key so he could bring her back to the apartment. And when Kevin is an idiot. He was actually helping the whole scenario, because when you hear the door go, Kevin goes, oh, Kirby, is that you? And he goes, no, it's Alec. And he looks at Leslie.
He's coming
and goes,
to get some tea and sympathy.
Yeah. And he looks at Kevin. He looks at Leslie and goes, I gave him a key. And this is where and you hear Alec go, did you or did you not tell Leslie about me screwing around with that other woman? And he goes, nope. And he goes, yep, I didn't think you did. Sorry. You know, I didn't mean to hit you, whatever. And he goes, I don't think I'm going to be able to get her back. And so when Kevin comes out of the bedroom and says, listen, buddy, can I talk to you, you know, tomorrow? And he goes, oh, sorry. So you got a woman there. But he goes, oh, I need to ask you, and, you know, is it the fat chick? Apparently there's a girl that Kevin had been talking to. And he goes, no, you got to tell me, is it the fat chick? And then suddenly Leslie comes out of the bedroom and goes, it's not the fat chick. And Alec goes, this is not happening. And this is where, because Kevin has been so infatuated with Leslie, that he starts to think there's a possibility of those two living together.
Having a relationship. And that's the thing, is Kevin and Leslie would be perfect together.
They would. But Leslie's like, I've got a whole lot of problems going on right now, Kevin. You can't expect me to suddenly go, oh, I'm going to go with you now, with the whole thing that's going on with Alec. Alec is.
And then finding out that he was helping Alec cheat.
Exactly. So it's like, well, you know, what do I do? And at one stage, at the end of the movie, we see that Alec and you got Leslie in the center, Alec on one side, Kevin on the other side. And she's like, you know, I love you both. But, you know, I want to be on my own for a while. Well, yeah. And of course, you know, Kevin's like, well, I thought I was the love of your life. And Alec's like, well, I thought I was the love of your life. And she goes, well, I love you both, but I'm going to try my life without loves for the moment, because I really don't want to go down this path anymore. But really, you know, Andrew McCarthy's character is not as stalkery as Kirby. It's pretty close when you got a box full of this woman's photographs. And he did say,
you have a box full, you have a phone full of pictures of me.
Well, but
are you stalking me?
Yes, at every turn, my darling.
Oliver, did you hear that? Daddy's stalking me.
But you know, this movie, in its essence, this movie really is about the coming of age from being in university or college to the real life that we all experience, and it's not, you know, a bed of roses a lot of the time. I mean, getting at the end of the movie, we see that Kirby's got to find a job because he's been fired from the businessman's work because he just trashed this poor guy's home. Jules has to get another job because she's been fired from her job for two weeks ago, and she's got nowhere to stay. She's got no furniture. She's got no nothing. So it really shows you that. And even Billy goes off to New York to play his sax. So really the only ones that are really together is Ally Sheedy's character, Leslie, Judd Nelson's character, and Mayor Whittingham and Kevin. Those are the only four that actually have got anything going. Everyone else is.
Well, I'm not even so sure about Kevin and Alec.
Well, no, they're okay. Mm-hmm. I think Billy's gone. So now we've really got Kirby and.
He's going to be couch surfing in Manhattan.
Yeah. But really, you know, Jules and Kirby are the two that really have to get their life together.
Yeah.
But look, on a scale of 0 to 5 movie reels, 0 being how do I get the last 108 minutes of my life back, to 5, it was a perfect movie and I'd watch St. Elmo's Fire all over again. What would you give this movie?
About a 3.
Oh, I am.
It's okay, but it's not anything. I mean, I will watch it when you're like, hey, let's watch this, but I wouldn't seek it out on my own.
Well, being the fact that I've watched every Brat Pack movie, I love them, the 80s. At great, great lengths, I'm going to give it a 4.5. I think it's wonderful. It is a great movie. And I think the soundtrack, and that's something we haven't talked about.
I have some stuff left about the soundtrack.
The soundtrack really makes this movie. It really draws you into the movie itself. Okay. But I love the characters. I mean, they're all damaged in some way, but I love all the characters. I love this movie.
Now, I do have a few bits of trivia to wrap up.
Okay.
So Andrew McCarthy started smoking while making this film, as his character was a smoker, but he did eventually quit. It was the breakthrough film for writer and former costume designer Joel Schumacher.
Okay.
And Joel Schumacher has said of the film's casting, according to the book You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes and Their Impact on a Generation, which was published in 2011 by Susanna Gora. He said a lot of people turned down the script. The head of a major studio called its 7-member cast the most loathsome humans he had ever read on the page.
Yeah, as I said, I don't try to go near any critic.
Columbia Pictures. Well, the studio executive said that.
Yeah,
not a critic, the studio executive. Now, Columbia Pictures hated the title, going so far as to send a 35-page memo listing all of their issues with the proposed title and suggesting such alternatives as The Real World and Sparks.
I like the fact they called it Sonoma's Fire because it did revolve around the bar, the Sonoma's Fire.
One of the bars used in the filming was torn down in Washington, D.C., and several of the cast members were in attendance.
Really?
Yep. The film's title, Sonoma's Fire, is derived from a real-life meteorological phenomenon which is mentioned in the movie. It is also known as Sonoma's Light. According to the website Wikipedia, it is a weather phenomenon in which luminous plasma is created by coronal discharge from a sharp or pointed object in a strong electric field in the atmosphere, such as those generated by thunderstorms or created by volcanic eruption. Andrew McCarthy's character has several witty lines that are lifted directly from Ian Scholes, a fictional pop culture critic created by Merle Kessler of the Duck's Breath Mystery Theater. Ian Scholes appeared on NPR's All Things Considered, as well as MTV's The Cutting Edge Happy Hour in 1983. St. Elmo's Fire credits give special thanks to Duck's Breath Mystery Theater.
Nice.
Yeah, I thought that was a little fun. And the production notes for this film state an outstanding ensemble of some of today's most talented and accomplished young actors stars as a tightly knit group of recent college graduates who face their freshman year of life. That's a great way to put this.
Yeah, it is.
Following their graduation, the intimate group of seven young men and women must confront as individuals all the issues of life after college in the 80s. In their commitments, careers, and relationships, the choices each makes will shape a lifetime and cause conflicts that test even their treasured friendship.
Yeah. And I just want to read the last part of the movie, because I think this last part of the movie is really sums up the whole movie.
Or do you want to save that until we're actually done?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the final film written by Joel Schumacher until Flawless in 1999, 14 years later.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of actress Gwyneth Paltrow's favorite films.
She's got good taste.
Yes. Well, I think so too.
Not Gwyneth Paltrow, the movie.
No, Gwyneth Paltrow has good taste.
Yeah, she does.
Okay.
She's got good taste in the movie.
All right. So then I have two pieces of trivia that are not the songs, and then the rest of it's about the songs. So the Booga Booga cheer that the friends do when they're celebrating or just in a good mood was not originally in the script.
No, it wasn't.
In a later interview, Rob Lowe stated that the cheer came out of observing fans whispering about the stars of the movie and then laughing. The cheer itself makes fun of what these whispered conversations sounded like from a few feet away.
Now, if anybody doesn't know what that sound like, they go, a booga, 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 ah, ah, ah. I know.
I wish you could see his face right now.
I have so much trivia in my brain that if I'm ever in a Turkish prison and they say, what is the booga booga thing to get out of prison? I can get out.
Well, hopefully you'll never be in prison.
I would not be in a Turkish prison, but I've got trivia. I've got that in my brain.
Now, one of my favorite, actually probably my favorite thing about this entire film is the Man on Fire song,
Man in Motion.
Man in Motion song. It's my favorite part of the entire movie.
The score is amazing.
Song. So singer John Parr, who co-wrote and sang the title song, St. Elmo's Fire, for the soundtrack, explained during a speech at the Children's Choice Awards in Sheffield that he was not particularly thrilled to be working on the film and that the song was written in honor of Paralympian and fundraiser Rick Hansen. He said that the wheels of the Man in Motion referenced in the lyrics was popularly thought to mean the wheels of Demi Moore's Jeep, but actually refers to those of a wheelchair. I did actually know that.
So
David Foster and handicapped athlete Rick Hansen were longtime friends who both needed a musical inspiration at the time. Foster needed a theme song for his movie. Hansen needed a theme to spark interest in his Man in Motion world tour. Hansen was circling the planet in his wheelchair to raise funds and awareness for his Spinal Injury Research Foundation. The song, St. Elmo's Fire, Man in Motion, was born with a portion of the proceeds going to the foundation.
Okay.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that one.
See, I finally got you one.
You got that one.
The instrumental love song and Man in Motion went to number one on the American Billboard Hot 100 chart on September 7th, 1985, and stayed there for 2 weeks.
That sounds about right. It is a good song. Right. It really is a good song. We can't play it on the podcast, but if you do happen to go and look for it on YouTube, you can find it. And it's a great, brilliant. a great song.
Well, and speaking of YouTube, in John Parr's music video for the movie St. Elmo's Fire, Man in Motion, and no, we did not plan that segue. It's a happy accident. All of the main cast, Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Andrew McCarthy, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, Ali Sheedy, and Mare Winningham appeared with Parr replaying their characters. Andy McDowell also appears, but in archival footage.
Mm-hmm. And if you see that that music video, you see that the bar St. Elmo's Fire, there's a sign on there saying gone out of business, and they're looking through the window into where they used to all hang out.
Okay. Oh, that's very nostalgic.
It's lovely.
Touching. So the instrumental song, the instrumental song Love Theme from St. Elmo's Fire, also written by David Foster. Did you know it actually has lyrics?
No, I didn't.
It is called Love Theme from St. Elmo's Fire, Just for a Moment. And John and Dino Elefante, who wrote and performed the song Young and Innocent, are also associated with the progressive rock band Kansas. John Elefante being most known for the lead vocal on the Kansas hit song Play the Game Tonight. Dino would later go on to produce for many Christian rock artists, such as the band Petra.
Okay.
And my final piece of trivia I absolutely love.
Okay. Final bit of trivia.
Final bit of trivia. I know. You're so relieved. So what was the name of Rob Lowe's character's band?
I don't know.
The New Breed.
Okay.
Okay. So
Patrick, we didn't actually have it. We didn't know it.
Patrick Winningham, who is the brother of lead cast member Mare Winningham, who played Wendy.
Yep.
He appeared in the film as a band member of The New Breed.
Nice.
Yeah, I love that one.
I like that. So that's similar to in 16 Candles, before we wrap up the movie. 16 Candles, Molly Ringwald's favorite band back then was the Rave Ups. So she always had her binder, had the Rave Ups name written on her binder, and she'd always have that facing the camera at all times, so she would actually show people that her favorite band was the Rave that. Ups.
But I think it's a little bit more akin to Ron Howard's brother always has a bit part in one of his movies.
Yeah.
He always makes an appearance in Ron Howard's films.
So now that this, you know, when I've said that there's the character development of all the cast members, I think this last part of the movie is really it tells it. So the last part of the movie is Alec and Kevin make up, and the group makes plans to go and meet for brunch. However, they decide not to go to St. Elmo's and instead choose Houlihan's because there are not so many kids there.
Yeah.
And then you start to see the title, the end credits, and that is the end of the movie. I love St. Elmo's Fire. I love the soundtrack. The actors, the actresses, I think it just ties together so beautifully.
I love the music.
Yep.
I love the actors.
You don't like
the movie itself. Meh, I can kind of take her. Okay, let's put it this way. We've watched this film at least twice in the last 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Every time you say, hey, we should watch St. Elmo's Fire, I'd be like, okay, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
That's
a lot of the time I'll be watching it and I'll glance over and Kat will be on her phone.
It's just not
out of 100% of attention, Kat will give it maybe 35% of her attention.
No, more than that.
It's just not a movie that you gravitate towards. But
no, it's because there's no real genuine growth to any of these characters, and they're not.
See, as I said, reading out all the characters, I think there is some growth in some of the characters. I think Kirby needs to grow up a lot, and
I think there's some, but there's not as much as I would have liked to have seen.
No.
You know, I think if this movie were made today, it would be a far different film.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Wendy can go much further other than a little bit more independence. She's got the independence. She's got her apartment. She's not living off her mother and father. She's got her own job. She's got
but
her own.
I think her.
I mean, I like it at one stage where she says to when she gets the car back after Kirby had taken it, and she took it to a repairman, and her father goes, oh, how did you go with the car? And she said, he fixed it all for nothing. And he goes, oh, good. And she goes, but I can't keep it because I don't feel right driving it to people who can't find money to eat. And he goes, well, that's okay. Keep the car. You and Howie are going to need it. And she goes, yeah, but I'm going to give the car and I'm going to give Howie back because I don't love Howie. I love Billy. You know, see, so you can see
that's the thing I would have liked to have seen with her is to grow up and realize what a child he is and that he is no good for her, and to kick him to the curb. Okay. I would love to have seen her kick Billy to the curb, yeah, and keep it that way, but still have that same conversation with her father and say, you know, it's like, I'm choosing me.
Yeah. But Wendy's too infatuated with Billy.
She's not
going to cut that cord. No, she's not going to cut that cord. That's going to be a very, very toxic relationship. Even Jules and Leslie have said this toxic relationship between you and Billy is way too explosive.
Yeah.
She just won't give him up, you know, as she says. But,
and that's the thing, is I really just don't see it.
And as she says at one stage to Leslie and to Jules, you know, it's like trying to give up smoking. You go for a long time and then you got to have a hit. She's like, that's exactly the way it was Billy. Is that I go for a long time trying to not be around him, and then suddenly I've got to go and not sleep with him. I just need to be around him to get that hit. So,
yeah.
But no, I love this movie.
But no, so. I would have liked to have seen her grow past that.
Yeah. So look, I hope everyone enjoys this new format that we've got. We just basically just talk a little bit about the movie and we go down the list of characters and we give you an overview
and talk
of the movie.
More about what we liked and didn't like about it.
Yeah, because this is really just one of those things where we're driving home from the movies and we're talking about what we liked and what we didn't like. And this is the way we're going to keep the format from now on. So,
and we're home now.
Hopefully you'll enjoy it. And we are home back in the home class movie chat. So, and we love our little segues we're doing. So, yeah, so that's the way we're going to be running the podcast from now on. So
thanks for coming and joining us again. And we hope you'll come back next time.
Yeah. So thank you very much for joining us this week. And next week, we will be back with another brand new episode of the Home Class Movie Chat.
And until then, enjoy your popcorn, drinks, and snacks.
We'll see you at the movies.